talking about these either the upper left-hand corner, this chart, and all this general or non-selective presence of the central nervous system, I think I could just talk a little bit about a substance called ketamine. Is that correct? Dissociative anesthesia. The drug doesn't provide a true general depression, but rather a dissociation, if you will, of the cortex and limbic system, structures in the forebrain, kind of dissociate away from the reticular activating system, that area of wakefulness or instant on that is in the midbrain and the hindbrain. So we've got this dissociation going. And I was asked a question after class, why do veterinarians still have it around? It tends to be anesthetic of choice for certain species, particularly cats. For some reason, cats, felines, you know, when I say cats, I usually mean house cats, but they have, maybe you're a vet at the zoo or something, you're doing lions or whatever. They don't do well with these general depressant drugs. They have quite a stage 2 reaction, disinhibition, as in, let's get wild and crazy, okay? And a wild and crazy cat just generally doesn't go over well at the vet office, so they use ketamine. There are a couple other more exotic species as well where it tends to be a drug of choice, but cats in particular. But there's one other type of anesthesia then that I have to just briefly mention. We'll talk about it more significantly when we get to that area. But that is a type of, and you might put it in quotes, but here is the term, neuroleptic analgesia. Sometimes you see it mis-termed neuroleptic anesthesia. But make no mistake about it, it's not really an anesthesia. You still have an RAS, a reticular activating system, pretty functional here. Neuroleptic analgesia, as the name implies, as we'll get to later in the course, is a combination of a neuroleptic, which is another term for antipsychotic, okay, neuroleptic, and a narcotic analgesic, an opioid. And the first product, and still the dominant product in this particular area, is a combination called Inobar, is a trade name. Inobar is a combination of the antipsychotic drug drolpiridol, Drolpiridol did not get gotten a whole lot of press, a whole lot of play by itself. It's a Me Too drug for what was a fairly commonly used drug called haloperidol or Haldol that McNeil developed, was widely used as an antipsychotic. Drolpiridol and the analgesic is one of the newer narcotics by the name of fentanyl. Drolpiridol and fentanyl in combination, Inobar. And as I indicated, what we've got here is a compound that has good, obviously good analgesia, and generally speaking, the drolpiridol acts kind of like ketamine. It kind of gets our mind away from what's going on. We can take a little bit of the trip. It's not a real phencyclidine type of trip, but we kind of dissociate ourselves away from the procedure. Now, don't get me wrong. You're not going to do an appendectomy or open heart surgery with this. This is for like stitching in the doctor's office, minor diagnostic procedures, used for like a sigmoidoscopy type of thing, where you think you need a little calming and dissociation for the patient. Those types of things, minor diagnostic office procedures. What's nice is it does not need to be given intravenously or by mask, so that's why it's so nicely used. Sometimes you see it used with nitrous oxide because it tends to have a relatively slow onset, and after all, time is money in the doctor's office, but often not. It's got fairly mild autonomic characteristics, not a whole lot of respiratory issues or cardiovascular issues with this drug. So this drug combination, I guess, this product, so it can be used quite easily in that regard. Okay, that being said then, we're going to continue on our journey through this upper left-hand corner. Talking about the group of compounds that I briefly mentioned when we were talking about IV induction agents. And that's the barbiturates, compounds. We're going to talk about them as an introduction into the context that we have here. And that is, instead of anesthesia, we want to stop at sedation and or hypnosis. And as you remember, I suggested that sedation is the term that the term that was in my pharmacology textbook, that's how old we're talking, that we now call anxiolytic, anti-anxiety. It's not sedation like let's get him asleep on the couch sedation. It's sedation like let's it's just a pharmacology test. Let's not crawl the walls or, peel off the ceiling. There's bigger things in life to deal with than a pharmacology problem, okay? Let's take the broad view. Type of anxiolytic type of thing, okay? Like, I could probably use one tomorrow about 6 o'clock when the trick-or-treat starts. It's a holiday, screw it. I live a block from Bronx Brothers. Does that name ring a bell with anybody? Okay. I live across State Street and a block into Brunt's Brothers on Marion Avenue. Marion and Rose parallel each other, at least 10 blocks long. And unfortunately, I mean, it's, nice area, nice place. All of the schools were very close when we bought the place. Why am I doing this? I'm behind as it is. But here's State Street. Brunks Brothers, Marion Rose, okay? 10, 12 blocks long, starting with the charter school down at this end across from the Dairy Queen. Does that ring a bell, too? Okay, and going all the way up to the fairgrounds. But I live on the inside, so what happens is everybody from the country brings their kids in. There's a donut shop and bakery called Van Brocklin's up here. They drop them off, say, go down, cross, come back. So the little troopers go down this way and this way. Right? And Mom and Dad are drinking hot chocolate and coffee at Van Brocklin's waiting for them. Okay? Anyhow, to get to the crux of the matter, okay, we usually have between 350 and 400 people stop by for trick-or-treating. Okay. And I don't do well with little kids to begin with. I teach in college, not kindergarten. I won't make another crack about that for fear that tonight's doubles night, isn't it? So you get the idea, right? Well, we have one. I got a little bit of that money on. We can use it for all that kind of good stuff. But, let's get back to that. All right. So we want some analytic action and or hypnosis. And remember, I suggested at the beginning of the discussion that to the best of our knowledge, for a long time, this was all about dose. That you probably had the same, if you will, mechanism of action, the same thing going on. It was just a matter of quantifying how much. We could not separate one from the other, from general anesthesia, from coma. It was all about dose. And so the big thing was to find a substance or a set of substances where you could dose just to here, not go down here, here, or here. We knew we could get through and get people sedated in hypnotics with our experience with these gases and or volatile liquids. But neither one of them is very practical if what you want is either anxiolytic or hypnotic activity. So we were looking for, if you will, molecular structures, and as you remember, the key came with the development of the barbiturate structure. And so that's what we're going to talk about for a few minutes, is the barbiturate and barbiturate types of drugs. And as you remember, fairly simple structure. And the only two things that I'm sure either Dr. Bonsher or Dr. Lustad are going to a little more depth. The only two things that I want you to remember chemically is, if this gets substituted into a sulfur group, we have a thiobarbiturate, a lot more liposoluble, right? Lipid soluble gets into the CNS very quickly. And how do we use thiobarbiturates? Inducing anesthesia, IV. And very quick in, quick onset, but as you remember, a very short duration because they redistribute very quickly, thiobarbs. The other thing is the R groups over here. If it's one phenyl group here, we start losing our sedative hypnotic qualities and start gaining anti-epileptic quality. And if it's two phenyl groups, there, R1 and R2 are both phenyls, you pretty much have lost hypnotic activity. You can still get some sedation, but that's about as far as it goes. However, you've really got a fairly decent anti-epileptic compound. And I might just caution, I'll say more about this when the time comes, but anti-epileptic and anti-convulsant are not synonymous. Okay. We've got anti-epileptic compound here, known as phenobarbital. Now, other than that, the only other thing I want you to notice and this is not how much can we memorize how fast in terms of the chart, okay? I just want you to understand that for the most part then, other than those two modifications to the basic structure, the only other thing you do is you play around with the structure and modify it is you modify its duration of action. So there were probably 50 50, that's 50 compounds in that neighborhood develop. Of those, probably only 8 to 10 made it to the market. And of the 8 to 10, you're looking at 6 of these, of the more prominent compounds. Now, the company that developed the barbiturate nucleus was Eli Lilly down in Indianapolis. One of the first things they did that made them a lot of money around World War II was developing barbiturates. And so of the ones that I'm looking at here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all but butabarbital were their patents and their compounds. Okay? But you'll notice that generally we group them based on duration of action into short-acting, intermediate-acting, long-acting. And long-acting, you'll notice, is associated with those phenyl groups over on the right-hand side, phenobarbital. Long-acting is an anti-epileptic, and also long-acting is a mild, and I repeat that, mild sedative. Every once in a while, you see a chart like this that has a fourth column, and it's ultra-short. And what's in there? The thiobarbs. Okay? But here we've got just a chart of sedative hypnotic types of preparations, and we generally see the three groups. Now, why the three groups? Basically, it's this. While these could be used for sedation, and often were, their biggest utilization was for hypnosis. And as you remember, I said hypnosis is kind of the medical pharmacologic term for, catch this, a sleep-like state. Not true sleep, a sleep-like state. We want to sleep. So the issue here is the condition that we call insomnia. Two types. Type one, induction insomnia. You can't go to sleep. Or the second one, which tends to be more common the older you get, is maintenance insomnia. Like my wife was up this morning at 3:30 doing crossword puzzles. That wouldn't be so bad, except she says, Rick. And I say, oh, no. For some reason, she can't remember New York Giant Slugger Mel Ott. O-T-T, Bob. Okay. It tends to be a common crossword thing. So here we are, maintenance insomnia. And as you might imagine then, for these drugs, I've already indicated, one of the issues with these agents is the tendency toward what we would call hangover, a drugged or loggy feeling the next morning. And the longer the action, the longer this hangs on, if you will. So if you've got induction insomnia, all you want is something that will get you down. You don't want to be hungover all the next day and then take another one the next night and then just repeat the cycle. So for induction insomnia, generally we tended toward the shorter acting compounds if it was a maintenance issue. How much do you get about sleep in physiology? Does he talk about sleep to any degree? You realize that sleep is a cyclical type of thing, right? And I've got it up, I think, on your handout, the whole idea of sleep being in stages. And you go up and down. And of course, maintenance insomnia is you come up and you bounce too high back to awake. Instead of this light sleep, you get all the way back to awake. There we would use an intermediate acting compound. Okay? Try and keep the people asleep through the 3 to 5 sleep cycles that generally people go through during a normal night's sleep, if you will. Okay? Now, Pentobarb, Secobarb, and Amobarb, all three, I'm trying to remember, Secobarb's easy, that was Secanol. Pentobarb and Amobarb, one was Nimbutol, and one was, I think Amobarb was called Amytal, A-M-Y-T-A-L. Secobarb was red. Amobarb was yellow, Pentobarb was blue. Capsules. Okay, 30 for $2.95. Take your choice. It's usually a doctor's preference to some degree, but that's how it was. And we would dispense probably, the pharmacy I was in Mount Pleasant, would probably dispense probably 25, 30 prescriptions for one or the other each week. 30 capsules, take one at bedtime. As needed for sleep, whether it be induction or maintenance issues. Okay? Very, very popular product, commonly used product across the country. In fact, there's a classic book and movie of the mid to late 60s called Valley of the Dolls. I don't know if it's available down at the corner family video, but if it is, it's kind of campy movie, if you will. But dolls was the slang term for barbiturates out on the West Coast, particularly in the Hollywood movie community. These colored capsules were called dolls. And people would go around asking if they had a doll that they could borrow or whatever, that kind of thing. So, very commonly used product. Again, mostly for hypnosis, although sometimes you would see a prescription for one of the shorter acting drugs for anxiolytic effect, not that often. Now, the other thing that they'll go into in chemistry is this, and I'll just mention it here. Barbiturates are the prototype, the classic compound for a phenomenon that we develop over the 50s and 60s called enzyme induction. And one of the things about barbiturates with enzyme induction is that a tolerance builds up. And so you need more and more and more of all these kinds of compounds, okay? I'll talk more to that on Monday, I would guess, but we'll see if I get to it today. The other thing about barbiturates is that they tend to act to a great degree on the reticular activating system, as well as higher areas. This wakefulness center, this instant on that we have, and that center can be, how would I say it, overcome in drug action. Did I talk about my wife's cousin and her wedding at all? Does that ring a bell? About 6 months, maybe a year after we were married, my wife was invited by her cousin, when they're about a month apart in age, to participate in her wedding as one of the bridesmaids, which I find, held in Saginaw, where the family lived, beautiful Congregational church over there, and then there was a country club the reception was at out on the west end off of 46. Swan Creek, does that ring a bell? Any Saginaw people here? Anyhow, very nice affair. We go over on Friday for the rehearsal dinner. You know, have a nice day, get through the wedding, this ringing a bell at all. Not even if it was, you'd say screw it, let it fall. So anyhow, what the thing is,
afternoon of the rehearsal dinner, my wife's cousin develops a rather severe headache, probably an anxiety-related headache. And the doctor gets called and prescribes Darvon capsules. Now, Darvon capsules are about the color of this shirt over here, okay? Kind of a wineish red, not red red, okay, but a wineish red. And Darvon 65, we'll talk about that too. It was prescribed quite commonly for people shit, but it was prescribed quite commonly for pain in those days. Darvon. Propoxetine, hydrochloride. And so she took one before the rehearsal dinner, had a headache after dinner and anxiety, took another one just before bedtime. And the next day, Saturday, the wedding's at 4 in the afternoon, about 1:30 to 2 o'clock. The mother of the bride says that maybe the bride ought to wake up and go to her own wedding. So she gets her out of bed, still has a headache, takes another capsule, wedding, still has a headache, another capsule, goes to reception, champagne toast, two or three drinks, still has a headache, another capsule, then they go on their honeymoon. And am I ringing the bell yet? After the honeymoon, about 6 months later, we go over, not that much, maybe 3 months later, we go over to visit the happy couple, and the groom takes me aside and says, "What a night." I said, "What night?" He says, "The honeymoon night." I said, "Oh, tell me all of you." Anyhow, what the bottom line is that he says, "Look at this prescription." And I look at it, for 165, 104 hours, be out of pain. Da-da-da-da, I look in the bottle, and guess what I'm staring at? I'm looking at Secanol capsules, secobarbital. A bright red capsule, same size as Darvon, but definitely a different color. With Lily's prescription on it. Okay? So this young lady had taken what should be one at bedtime is needed for sleep, had taken a half a dozen or so of it in 24 hours, plus alcohol, and it functioned through the wedding and the reception quite normally. Mind over matter. Guess what happened as she started to relax in the car on the way to the honeymoon hotel? He said the honeymoon night, he had to carry her over the threshold by necessity. And that she was pretty much non-participatory until about 3 o'clock this afternoon. Was it good for you? Hell, I don't know. You get the picture. What I'm trying to say is, this is the example I use, and I talk about it a lot with the placebo effect, okay? A lot of these central nervous system drugs in particular, their effectiveness or lack thereof depends to a great degree on the mentality, the mindset of the individual that's taking them. What was this drug being taken for? Pain. So I don't need to go to sleep. I don't want to sleep. Okay? And it wasn't like instant tolerance. That doesn't happen. But that's the issue. Okay? So understand that. Barbiturates. The classic generalized sedative hypnotic drug. Now, I have in the outline then some ideas about sleep. Okay. Notice that generally speaking, with induction insomnia, if you are having rather consistent trouble getting to sleep within an hour after you hit the pillow. Interesting. I just said the word insomnia and I saw about 5 or 6 yawns around the room at lobbying or something. More than an hour on a consistent basis, generally we will diagnose induction insomnia and get you something. Okay? maintenance insomnia, generally if you're waking up after 3 to 4 hours of sleep, now you're talking, let's try maintenance, okay? Get to sleep fine. And then, well, you can go through the material on the various stages of sleep. The only one I want to highlight, you probably have it highlighted in physiology, is REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. So-called because if you open the eyelids of the individual that's sleeping, the eyeballs will be fluttering around, having all sorts of, I won't call them spasmodic, because they really aren't, but they're fairly noticeable eye movements. In the male also, there will be erectile activity very commonly. There's some issues autonomically that you can read about. But the big thing here is that it is pretty well determined now that most of our really refreshing time to sleep happens during this period of time. Dreaming tends to occur here. And that if you are sadistic, and some sleep labs were, as we started looking into this, and you put a person, hook them up to all sorts of apparatus, and every time they try to go into REM sleep, you blast them out of it, they will very quickly start developing mental issues, sleep deprivation types of issues, maybe even psychotic, hallucinatory types of tendencies. So it's an important component of the sleep cycle, REM is. Okay? Notice as a young, healthy adult, you generally will get to your first REM in around an hour to 90 minutes if you're outside. It will be about 5 to 10 minutes long, and you'll start coming back up. And notice that the majority of REM sleep occurs during the last one or two of five sleep cycles in a normal individual. Most normal individuals take about five sleep cycles, or anywhere from an hour and 10 minutes to 90 minutes long. So generally, we're looking at 7 to 8 hours of sleep. And most of the REM occurs in the last quarter of the sleep period. Important because with a maintenance insomnia problem, what are you losing a lot of? That refreshing REM sleep, which tends to start catching up with the rest of the system, okay? So take a look at all of that. The byline is that as we started learning more and more about this, and by the way, what we're talking about here is all of this research has been done since I got out of pharmacy school. Sleep research generally is in the 70s, late 60s through the mid-70s, okay? And so we had some issues with barbiturates as they become more popular. Obviously, one of the issues is the tolerance phenomenon, enzyme induction. But another big issue is, while they put you into what did I define hypnosis as? A sleep-like state, it was not true sleep. We knew that kind of intuitively because people would be waking up and they wouldn't be refreshed. So we said, something's odd here. And in fact, as we look at barbiturates, after we put this whole sleep thing together, we discover that one of the things that happens is that barbiturates tend to maintain a person in stage two. That is the only stage that significantly increases as a part of the sleep cycle. All of the other stages, including REM, tend to be depressed in terms of their length or duration. And so while you were under, quote, 6 hours or so, maybe 8, it wasn't a true sleep. And the fact you weren't getting all of the REM you wanted, that was part of the hangover, the drug feeling. You weren't as refreshed as you would normally be if you didn't need to take the drug. Okay? And the tendency would be, and was, because of the tolerance phenomenon and because of this lack of efficacy, if you will, in producing normal sleep, people would start popping in not one, but 2, 4, 6, whatever. And as soon as you get to those types of doses, now you've got some issues. Just a couple of them. Respiratory depression. A big thing. Point one. You also saw some tolerance to this, but it did not develop as quickly as the tolerance to the hypnotic action. So what we tend to do is narrow our safety index. Respiratory depression. Now you have 3 involuntary drives to respiration. The neurogenic drive, the respiratory center in the medulla. The hypercapnic drive. The chemoreceptor drive, if you will. Too much carbon dioxide, and you trigger a response that says we got to blow some of this off. Chemo drive. Hypercapnic. And the third is the hypoxic drive. Different set of receptors. It says too little oxygen. We've got to get some more in here. Stimulate respiration. 3 involuntary drives. All right. While it tends to be the most sensitive drive, the one that tends to get depressed first, all right, the rate of depression tends to be the shallowest for the hypoxic drive. Okay. Here you've got these 3 drives. One that starts being depressed first is hypoxic. These keep going, but shortly after they start becoming depressed, but they tend to depress on a much steeper, if you will, incline. So that when you get out toward potentially lethal doses, what's the only drive that's keeping you respiring? Hypoxic. Moral of the story. What don't you want to put into the individual? Oxygen. Unless you've got some sort of mechanical respiratory assistance available. Because the minute you load them up on oxygen, guess what happens? They stop breathing. Okay. Respiratory depression. And for the most part, I won't say 100%, but I would say a good 3 out of 4 or 4 out of 5 cases, here's cause of death with these generalized CNS depressants, respiratory depression. And I might say that this response is potentiated by alcohol, which is also, that's ethyl alcohol, which is also a general depressant. So So people would get in trouble commonly. They'd put in three or four barbiturates and wash it down with a fifth of Jack Daniels, and we have an issue. Okay? Or other Halloween party or something. Respiratory depression, a big problem. In addition to respiratory depression, as you might expect, other medullary areas become depressed. Those of a cardiovascular nature. So we may see some problems with blood pressure. You know, normally you start seeing a vascular problem because you depress the vasomotor center in the medulla. And what should you be seeing as a reflex? Reflex what? Tachycardia. But we've also started depressing cardiac centers as well. So that may or may not happen. Tendency with barbiturates is to decrease blood pressure. Another thing that's depressed that tends to be a problem is the thermoregulatory centers in the medulla and or the hypothalamus. Why did barbiturates become so popular in warm weather areas? This wasn't as much of a problem. When you start taking barbiturates rather chronically here in this particular season, and you're going to have to start wearing heavy sweatshirts, coats, da-da-da-da-da. You know, look around the room and you see because of the drop in thermoregulation, drop in body temperature. Okay. One final thing, and then I'm going to do my segue to Wednesday or Friday. No, this is Friday. Monday. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I did this one. The other thing is that the enzyme induction, those enzymes are the same enzyme systems that do testosterone. Remember that one from drug action? Okay, barbiturates are the classic sex or gender difference drug. One of the first ones where we discovered it. Rather distinct difference. Because they have not had to deal with testosterone, females' enzymes for dealing with barbiturate are much lower, so barbiturates tend to be much more efficacious in females than in males. This tended to lend a little bit more to females becoming, if you will, hooked on barbiturates more easily. Because they were more efficacious. They go to sleep faster, they sleep a lot longer. But we'll let it go at that. Now, the segue I want to just do, and what we're going to be talking about, I'll finish up some of the decal of barbiturates, but what we'll really be talking about on Monday is this. Somewhere either in this section or in the following section on benzodiazepines and anxiolytics, you have this little thing, which is one of the better depictions I've ever seen for this particular item. This is a receptor. The receptor is known as GABA sub A. And GABA sub A, as a receptor, is all about chloride ion transfer across membranes. Okay? As opposed to GABA sub B, which is G protein-like. But GABA sub A is an ionic flux receptor, as I indicated before. And GABA which is an acronym for gamma-aminobutyric acid, is the primary, at least at this point in time, for our thoughts here, is the primary inhibitory neurotransmitter in the central nervous system. And it provides that inhibition through chloride ion transfer to hyperpolarized membranes. And my last thought then is, it's everywhere, it's everywhere. And that's why these compounds can be, quote, general, unquote, depressants. Gamma A receptors are pretty much universal throughout the central nervous system. And if you affect one with a barbiturate, you don't affect them all. Now, how they affect is the hook for Monday. We'll see you then. Have a nice weekend.